Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 140 of Criminal Justice Evolution. That's CJ Evolution, a podcast for the criminal justice professional like you, hosted by me, Patrick, another CJ professional. I'm also the host and creator of CJ Evolution. We would not have 140 episodes, everybody, if it wasn't for you, the listener, sharing it with family and friends. Thank you for the continued support. Special thanks to all those first responders out there, especially in law enforcement, the brave men and women that put on a uniform every day, risk everything to go out there and protect us. Some of the people who are not, doesn't seem like they're very grateful, but millions of other people, folks, support you and what you do every day. Thank you for what you're doing. Do you want to unlock that cognitive genius that resides between your ears? I'm talking about your brain. Great guest on today. Her name is Dr. Berit Brogard. She's a PhD. She's also a professor and the director of the Brogard Lab for Multisensory Research at the University of Miami. Her educational background includes a medical degree in neuroscience and a doctorate in philosophy. She is also the author of a recent book, as well as many other publications. The recent book is called The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain. It was amazing talking to Dr. Brogard. She is a brilliant woman, obviously, and she will teach you how to unlock those secrets in your brain to get you to that next level. So without further delay, here is the one and only Dr. Berit Brogard. Welcome back, everybody. Very excited to have Dr. Berit Brogard in the house. Doctor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Now, thanks for having me on.
Oh, of course. You're doing amazing things. Have an amazing background. For those out there who don't know who you are, can you just give us a little background on yourself?
Yeah, I'm a professor of philosophy at University of Miami. I also have a background in neuroscience, so I try to combine theoretical aspects with applications in neuroscience, and I look at perception and consciousness as well as various applications of those. I also look at extraordinary talent that people develop after accidents when they have brain injuries.
Now, you came across a man by the name of Jason Paget. Can you tell us who that gentleman is? I remember reading about him, but for the listener out there.
Yeah, Jason Paget was a person working in a furniture store. He still works in a furniture store. And he was not up to anything intellectual. He had dropped out of college, had not taken much math at all. And then he was mostly interested in, back then, in partying.
So he partying? No.
Yeah. So he went to a karaoke bar, and when he got out from the karaoke bar, two people attacked him, and that involved a blow to the head, and he went unconscious, not for long, but he went unconscious, and when he got he also had some injuries elsewhere, and he got to the hospital. And when he got out of the hospital, he realized that his way of perceiving the world had changed, that he sort of saw the world in new ways in terms of complex geometrical patterns, and that he had a sudden interest in understanding the mathematics that he thought would underlie those geometrical patterns. So he went back to college, sort of at night and whenever he could fit it in. And then he started understanding the geometrical patterns that he saw in terms of the math that he learned. So he had a new insight into mathematics, in the sense that he can explain certain mathematical things using different kinds of geometrical patterns that are not standardly used in mathematics. So that's among his extraordinary talents. He's also hand drawing what he's seeing. So you can see some of those on the internet. He has several pages with some of his drawings on them. And the drawings are really incredible. So they're hand drawn.
Now, when the doctors, I'm assuming they did CAT scans, MRIs, what were they saying? I mean, you said he took a blow to the head, and I don't know the backstory. I mean, I've heard of Jason, but What were they saying? What happened in his brain that unlocked this ability?
So it has involved. He did indeed have a lot of scans at the time, but they were mostly focused on the trauma that he had some trauma, for instance, to his neck, and so they're mostly focused on that trauma he had, and not so much on what caused his perception to change, because that didn't to them at the time seem to be necessarily a problem. Maybe it took him a little bit longer to realize how much his perception of the world had changed. So when he was actually in the emergency room, he did not actually, I don't think he was aware yet how affected he was. But then since then, we have both looked at the old scans, and we have looked at new scans that we have done together with some people, collaborators. And we have found that his perception is due to some changes in very localized areas, in the areas that is connected with mathematics in the parietal cortex on the top of the head, which can be a result, it's hard to say in his case, but it can be a result of damage to the frontal lobe. So the front of the brain, when you damage that, can sometimes make other parts of the brain sort of overcompensate in some sense, and that may have been what has happened in his case.
So do we all have this ability, Doctor?
That's part of what we have tried to argue based on some of these cases, that if you have these ordinary people who can't predict that they will be in an accident where they sustain a brain injury, and then they suddenly develop these extraordinary talents, then or new ways of perceiving the world, then it would seem that, well, we could all be in that situation, right? We don't recommend that you go out and knock your head into a wall or something, but don't do that,
folks.
Right, but we could, right? We could, in principle, be in the same situation, and so we must have that potential in the brain for the most part. So we can't predict that everyone has it, but it must be more than just the people that we sort of identify in society as being the particularly creative or original or intelligent people, right? So,
and you have so much work out there, publications. You have a book out there, your recent book, The Superhuman Mind: Free the Genius in Your Brain. Can you talk a little bit, because that's what we're talking about, right?
I mean,
that is
exactly that book where we talk a lot about these cases. We talk about other cases too. We talk about cases where people have extraordinary talent from birth, so such as in cases of autism, where people are sometimes in super savants, which means that they have sort of extreme, extraordinary talents in a narrow area, so mathematics or calendar calculation or drawing or finding their way around the world. And we also talk about some of the technology that is being developed, that is being researched in terms of perhaps creating or simulating these kinds of injuries in normal people, so not actually causing them, but in order to bring out some extraordinary talents. And one way to do that is to use some temporary magnetism that can affect the brain, but only temporarily. So to sort of simulate the conditions of a brain injury.
And it really is an amazing time to be alive, because we have the technology, and I don't know neuroscience, obviously, like you do, but we live in an amazing time where, you know, years ago we couldn't do this. We couldn't simulate that stuff. Maybe we could. You would know better. But we, as time goes on, we're learning more and more about the brain, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. We learn more and more, and we still have a really long way to go. But yes, we have much more technology than we used to have, and it keeps developing. And we keep as the technology is developing, we can also find out new things about the brain that we were unable to figure out before.
And I'm thinking about I'm sure you've seen that movie Rain Man with Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman.
Yes.
Where he has autism, I believe. Dustin Hoffman does in that movie.
Yes.
And he's like does all this math in his head. So he was tapping parts of his brain, right?
That's right. That's right. He's modeled on a real case.
Wow.
Twin Peaks. So, but although the real person did not have autism, but they have then sort of created the character to have autism. But some of the abilities of the character in Rain Man are the same abilities that the real person had.
Now, are there people? I mean, so this was an actual case, but what about the person out there that just has autism? I mean, I guess there's different types, right? I mean, forgive my ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Different types of autism, or different?
Yes.
I mean, there certainly are different types many different types of autism. A lot of psychologists believe that autism, that's why it's called an autism, spectrum disorder, right? So it's not necessarily one condition, and not necessarily one underlying brain condition. And in some cases, it might have a genetic component to it, or like in most cases, but it may not have the same genetic component to it in all cases. And some are high functioning, and that refers primarily to their ability to function in society. Some are low functioning, but then in addition to that, then some of the people with autism have extraordinary abilities, and that can be both the people who are low functioning as well as the people who are high functioning, because that they might be unable to function in a sort of the way that people normally are required to function in society, but yet have a special talent. So you don't have to be high functioning to have that special talent.
It's amazing. What do you think about the phrase, and I know you've heard it, and all of us have, you know, we only use a certain percentage of our brain. I think it's 10%. What do you think about that? I mean, do you think that's accurate or what?
I think a better way to put it, though we don't know the exact percent, is to say that we use only 10% of the potential of our brain. So there are no areas of the brain that is not used in at least some minimal way. Or it would be pruned away, as we call it. So when the brain has its own mechanisms to kill off pathways that are not in use, and kill off areas of the brain that are not in use. And so that kind of pruning, that happens a lot more in children and teenagers and young adults, but it does in fact happen all life long. So what you can have is some, for instance, some unconscious mental states, so mm-hmm. mental states that you're not aware of that you can become aware of. You can also have some minimal activity in certain areas of the brain where that activity can suddenly become stronger. And you can also have suddenly develop new neurons in certain areas of the brain or new brain connections. And so there are various ways in which that old saying that we only use 10% of our brain can be true, but it would have to be reformulated in one of those ways.
So what would happen if we used 100% of her brain? I'm thinking another movie, you've probably seen it, Lucy, where she used she used 100%. Now I know it's Hollywood and just Hollywood, but she had some amazing abilities. Is it possible? I mean, I guess anything's that we could be like that. I mean, you know, using kind of mind control and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I wouldn't probably not call it using 100%, because there's probably in real life, if that were to ever happen, and it seemed like, oh wow, you're using 90% more of whatever area. So you have access to 90% more areas than you did before, mm-hmm. Where you can sort of use those areas of the brain where before the brain could only use them by itself. Then you can't say, oh, now I've used up all the potential the brain has, because it could still develop new neurons and new connections. So I wouldn't ever say that you have always, I mean, that there comes a point where you've used 100% of the brain's mm-hmm. capacity and but let's say that you could access a lot of things in the brain, and there are people in some extraordinary people who remember just everything from all parts of their lives, even if it's random symbols or random strings of numbers and so on. And they sometimes suffer from certain kinds of disabilities because of that. Because imagine you can remember everything that you are told or that you see, and it doesn't mean that you have to have it all in your conscious mind all the time.
Sure,
but it can come up, right? Just like
you can access it. You can access it very simply. But why are some people? How do some people have that ability? And maybe it's a curse to some people, but why do some people have it and some people don't? Is it just a product of environment or what?
It's in some cases it can be genetically determined. It can be a product of the environment, but it has to do with how the brain is connected, in particularly locally. So what I mean by locally is that when you need certain long range connections from say one hemisphere to another hemisphere, or from one part of the brain to another part of the brain to be a good decision maker, and maybe to do things like multitasking, and maybe also in terms of being original and creative in certain areas. But then there are certain kinds of extraordinary talent that would require much more localized connectivity that is much stronger than what you see in a brain that has these long-range connections, more of those long-range connections. And so what you see is sort of a brain that lacks some of the long-range connections, and instead is sort of using its power to have these more this more tightly connected network in more localized areas.
It's amazing. I remember going back, in college, I remember I had, friends that, I always had to study really hard. I mean, you probably know where I'm going with this. And then I had friends that could look at something very briefly or a short period of time, and they would ace everything.
Yes. So some people are just able to commit things to memory a lot faster than others. And that again has to do with the structure of the brain. This is something that you can train. So there are so-called people who do memory sports, so in memory champions, who don't necessarily have it, they strengthen that. That's something they want to do. They want to actually go to the Olympics in memory, which is a discipline, and so they might spend like 2 or 3 years strengthening their memory to the point where they can do that. So it's not necessarily that you're born with that ability. So in many cases, when you see people in school, maybe they are just born with that ability, and they might not have been sitting down trying to strengthen their memory. But you can also, in some cases, do it through training.
And I think some parents out there, correct me if I'm wrong, are realizing this earlier, and they're jump starting with their kids when they're very young, because we have so much knowledge at our fingertips now that they're getting their little toddlers enrolled in classes that can help with this. It's going to make them smarter in the long run.
Yeah, that's one thing that some parents do. Another thing that some parents do is that they teach their kids these shortcuts that people sometimes use automatically, but sometimes so by shortcut I mean there are ways of remembering things that will make it easier for you to remember things. So the less meaningful something is, the less likely to you, the less likely you are to remember it, right? And even if you try, if you have to remember multiplication as a little child, that might seem like not very meaningful, and it might seem just like some random facts. But if you get sort of a little more of an understanding of what these simple, so one-digit multiplication tables and so on, what they actually are based on, it would be easier to see the patterns and remember them. And then sometimes, of course, there are rules, like if you multiply something with 9, there's a rule, there's a shortcut you can take. And so parents use sometimes also, they teach not just their kids things or facts or information, but also ways to learn. So how do you actually learn? How do you become a better learner? And so that's an important thing that is not always taught in school.
Now, and you talk about in your book, The Superhuman Mind, you talk about expecting to see, we talked a little bit about technology, maybe we could talk a little bit more on that, but drugs too that will help harness these abilities. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that, Doctor, with the drug aspect of it?
Yeah, there are some drugs that hold some potential. One is a psychedelic drug that is found in so-called magic mushrooms, and it's in the isolated form is called psilocybin. Mm-hmm. And it's not completely unrelated to LSD in terms of its effects, but it's a cleaner drug, and it is being used in research in the U.S. And it has proven to it holds some potential in various ways. So people have shown that people can become more open-minded in the sense of being more creative and original by being exposed to a heavy dose of this drug one time. That 12 months later, even 14 months later, they were still more open-minded in the sense of being more creative. So it's a special kind of open-mindedness that they were talking about. But there are also various benefits for depression and mood disorders and so on.
So do you think down the road that this is going to be just something that a person can go and get a prescription for, or what?
Maybe a prescription, yes. I think that it might be a restricted prescription because it can be abused, and so it might be a prescription drug. I doubt that it will be something that you can just go down and buy in the grocery store.
Hey, can I get those bag of mushrooms over there?
Yeah, right. And also, you would never use the mushrooms because it's so unpredictable where in the mushroom you actually have the big concentrations of the drug. So yeah.
Well, that's interesting that it brings out creativity. Do you think creativity is undervalued?
I think it's highly undervalued. I mean, it's creativity in very many areas of life as well as in many professions can be very beneficial. It's definitely undervalued, I think, and it's probably more valued in my profession, where in academics, because you have to think up new experiments or you have to come up with new hypotheses in order to do your research. But I think that in many other areas of life, it's probably undervalued.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've done some work with law enforcement, Doctor. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes. Yeah, so my co-author Christian Malo, he was actually down working in a newer law lab. So it's not directly law enforcement, but mm-hmm. it has to do with law enforcement in the sense that what they were looking at, among other things, was to see if there would be ways to, for instance, use brain scans as in ways that we are currently using lie detectors, for example, by taking a shortcut, so you would bypass perhaps some of the problems with, say, a lie detector or other things that can be important in the law. So it may be that some conditions really should count as, say, legal insanity, right? Or then some conditions should not. So that is this big area that's called neurolaw, where aspects of neuroscience is combined with law, the aspects of the law, and so that's something that we have talked a lot about. That not so much in the book. We get into it a little bit in the book, but we also have a blog where we have talked a bit about that on Psychology Today, and there are projects that my co-author is running. That involve some aspects of neural law. So neural law is definitely sort of an up and coming area, a very fairly new area.
I have never heard of that. I've been in this, and maybe I should have. but it's fascinating to think about. So you're looking at, you know, I mean, I liked what you said about how you can do maybe down the road like a scan of the brain to see if somebody's being deceptive, because that's really all that a lie detector is, you know,
yes.
Or a voice stress analyzer is you're detecting deception. And if you could do
a
brain scan, I think it would be even better, right?
Yeah, yeah. It would be down the road because it's obviously too coarse-grained at this point. But once you can, once we know a little bit more about, because the problem is that some people can actually cheat on a lie detector.
Oh, of course.
If they're really good at it. But there are certain, I mean, so what researchers would like to find out is a way to detect that. So when people cheat, right, we may be able to see that they're cheating because they're not just answering the questions without having, you know, the heart rate going up or whatever. They're also actually engaging in some kind of deception. So that would be one way that you could see if they're being deceitful, perhaps by seeing, this part of the brain that is usually involved in deceptive behavior. So this should raise a red flag. And so there may be various ways of combining different, looking at different areas of the brain on a brain scan to bypass the problems with current lie detectors. Whether they would be safe enough to use in court, I don't know, but it certainly could help public discovery and investigation.
Yeah, and I was going to say that is something that I imagine, you know, that would be, you know, argued in court, you know, the validity behind that. There's always going to be people that say, oh, no, kind of like with the lie detector. Lie detectors, for the most part, are not used in court.
Unless
they're agreed, you know, by both parties.
But they have, they can help investigators, right?
Oh, yeah.
The police, to a large extent, because I mean, about just the fact that some people are willing to take it can maybe give them a clue. There are ways to use it, even if it's not admissible in court.
Interesting. Do you think? And I know we kind of talked about this a little bit that we have these superhuman abilities, or, you know, they lie dormant, right?
Yeah. So the superhuman abilities that we argue that most or all of us have are dormant in a sense. Either they lie as a potential, or they're dormant in the sense that they're not accessible to consciousness, so we're not aware of them, we're not aware of how to use them. Or they could also be literally dormant in the sense that something needs to happen in order to increase the activity in those areas such that it can actually be used or be useful. And that's something we see even beyond just sort of the brain, like people who are paralyzed in accidents that, unlike what people thought like just a few years ago, mm-hmm. it turns out that they do have some signals, right, in the areas that of the central nervous system that they thought were the reason that were paralyzed was that they didn't have any activity there, but they do have some activity, and some people are trying to find out how to intensify that activity so that they can potentially get to walk again, for example.
That's amazing, and I've heard of stories, as of you, obviously, that, you know, people who were you know, told they couldn't walk again, and then they just willed themselves to do it, and obviously that involves the mind and willpower, and it's just amazing what the mind can do.
Yeah, so that involves some way of intensifying that activity. So, of course, you have to either, I mean, there's two things that can happen. Either you have to have the brain area with the activity in it, or you would have to develop. So the brain is plastic or flexible, and so it can sometimes develop the abilities that you lost.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, Doctor. I mean, we live in a world, as you know, and the listeners know, where we're just bombarded with information every day. It's like information overload. Do you think that helps us or hurts us in terms of, you know, our cognitive abilities, the ability to remember stuff? I mean, what do you think?
I think for that, some people can handle it, and then there's some people who absolutely cannot handle it. So one theory of autism, in fact, is that they're very sensitive to too much information, and that a lot of their social problems that is a result of that sensitivity to information. So they can't even sort of function maybe with an ordinary level of information. So if you go to neurotypical people, so people who don't have autism, then some people will be more sensitive to that overload of information, and other people will be able to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And if you are, so it could be in most cases probably it could be a hindrance because there's so many distractions. And the way that our attention works is that it can't, I mean, if it's so if it's flooded with information, then it's not gonna be able to filter out what's important and relevant. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people can't handle all that information and try to shut out some of that information that's constantly coming in.
Now, how can we? I imagine doing games and stuff like that to test our brain and to exercise our brain is probably a good thing to do. I mean, how can we take care of the general health of our brain? Because we all need our brains.
Yeah, right. I'm not going to advertise any products, but there are products, commercial products already that sort of will strengthen your memory and your ability to cognize or your cognitive abilities. So there are products out there, computer programs that you can sort of go through half an hour a day to do that. But of course, they become better and better over time. So I'm not necessarily going to recommend what's out there,
sure,
but
sure.
There are things out there, products on the market, computer programs that are commercially available for ordinary people that you can use. And other than that, I mean, there are lots of other things you can do yourself, but it's usually easier if you get a piece of software or something you download from the internet. I mean, you could always download some not too hard puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of puzzles and problem solving puzzles and so on that you can download from the internet, access from the internet, for example, and that will help you sharpen your skills definitely. So, and then you can maybe move to harder puzzles over time.
Because it's a muscle, we need to use it. We need to exercise. We need to keep it going, or it's just gonna kind of wither.
It's true. It's an organ. I mean, just like if you didn't use another part of your body ever at all, right? If you didn't get any blood circulation or something, it would fall off. So,
yeah.
Similarly, like the brain is an organ, and the parts you don't use, they will go away.
Now, how does nutrition factor in, because obviously we need to be eating right. I mean, if we're eating crap all the time, that's not going to help our brain, right?
Yeah, no, that's super important. It's something we discuss in the book as well, that it's super important that we get the right kinds of nutrients, and one can do that by eating a healthy varied diet, or by knowing which supplements to take. Because there are certain things that the body can't produce and that do matter to how we feel in terms of mood and how good we are in terms of cognition.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that most people are aware of by now is just like the essential, the fish oils, right? So the fish oils in fatty fish, for instance, is absolutely central to how the brain functions. And a lot of people are aware of that. So they should eat more tuna and salmon, for example, or take some fish oil supplements. But that's just one example of many, many, many examples.
And it's amazing, like I said before, I mean, you know this, I mean, just how much we learn along the way, because I don't remember talking about this, or my parents talking about this when I was growing up.
No, I don't remember that either. When I grew up, that was not what they would say. They would say, "So you should eat this or that to get strong muscles,
yeah.
You know, so you could do your push-ups better or something like that."
Yeah. We're becoming smarter, right?
Yeah, but that is a result. But that was not sort of maybe people could think that it might have mattered, but it wasn't. Yeah, it's true. It wasn't something that people talked about that much.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Brogaard, I know you got to go, and I really do appreciate you coming on the show. If people want to reach out to you, Doctor, how can they find you?
They can find me, for instance, on Psychology Today. I have a blog that's called The Superhuman Minds. I also actually run another blog that's sort of unrelated to that. It's called The Mysteries of Love, which is more sort of obviously about emotions. And other than that, there's also, I have a page for The Laboratory, which is Brogaard, Brogaard, lab.com. So that there's a little more information on that page.
Any social media out there, Doc?
I have a Facebook page that's accessible sort of to the public, and I'm also on Twitter, Brit Here Now, at cool. Brit Here Now.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, Doctor.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
All righty, have a good day and continue that great work you're doing.
Well, thank you, and all right. Likewise.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.